You're listening to Conversations with John Anderson, featuring Jim Molan.
Well, Jim, terrific to have this chance to talk. I wanted to begin, though, by saying, particularly some young people, they've lived in peace for a long time. They might feel that you and I are a couple of old warmongers. You're a former general looking for a new battle. I'm a former member of a government that they might think was too aggressive. You must have seen real reasons to hate the idea of war.
Yes, and I think the people who are most reluctant to ever commit to war is the military. It's rarely do you find the military standing in the front rank of those who want to go to war. I think if you spend all of your life studying war and going to war, you realise how dangerous it is, not just for infrastructure, not just for people, not just for reputations, but for nations as a whole. And my experience I had 40 years in the military, and for most of that period was a period of when we were in government, the Liberals and Nats were in government. And one of the greatest problems we face in going into the world, into the future, is that most Australians don't believe we will ever have to fight again.
Yeah.
One of the greatest benefits of the last 75 years is that most Australians have never had to fight. And I think back to the ugliness that I've seen, and it really goes to the impact of war we have this view of soldiers, but the impact of war is most appalling on families. It's most appalling on civilians. And you can historically look back and see the appalling impact throughout the 20th century. Geraldine Doogue used to say that it was a charnel house. When you start from the Boer War, the First World War, even during what we call the interwar years, the Mediterranean, Abyssinia, Spain. We then got into the Second World War. We came out of the Second World War. What are the figures in the Second World War? There's something like, something between 20 and 70 million people died in that.
And many of them were starvation because of what was
absolutely
happening, forced on them by warring nations elsewhere.
Yes, and a human society is very, very fragile. And we saw what happened in 1919 when our soldiers had spent 4 years of extraordinary warfare. They'd won the war, they all relaxed, and what hit them? Flu. When you take a society and you take, because our societies are so dense now, you take away the props to our society and our societies collapse fairly fast. And we've seen that in some of the disaster relief stuff that I've done over the years. But the first really savage war that I was involved in was right at the end of my career, and it was the Iraq War. And compared to the wars of the world, our commitment to Iraq was a bubby's war. It was a small war. In the 8 or 9 years that we were committed to this, that the West was committed to this war, probably 150,000 Iraqis died. That's roughly 10,000 a year. I always say that 10,000 died in the 1 year that I was there. Of the American forces, probably 1,000 died. The 10,000 who died were really the results of fighting in a community, of fighting through cities, of a total failure by our enemies to adopt what the West has adopted for many years, and that is the laws of armed conflict. An incredible use of violence to achieve their political aims. We didn't see that again until the Islamic State came. So we fought. I had absolutely no problems with the insurgents on a moral basis because we were occupying their country. They were fighting against us. I understood that. But when you got to the terrorists such as Al-Qaeda, that was something new. The violence that I saw in Al-Qaeda put what we saw in East Timor into the background, and then we didn't see it again until they raised it to yet another level when the Islamic State came out of it. So when you can, I used to one of the most demanding things I did was called time sensitive targeting, and I was an authorising and implementer of what we called time sensitive targeting. You'd find your intelligence would tell you that at a certain place, a certain time, that there would be a meeting of a local insurgent group. And we would have drones in the air, we would watch this area, and young analyst, 19-year-old American analyst, would be responsible for four blocks of a city, and they'd watch this area and they'd watch people come together, scouting the area out. We'd pick the house that they were going to, and maybe we knew it, we were following the car. And we would ultimately hit them with a bomb and kill them. We went through a legal process in order to do that, to make sure that we were operating in accordance with the laws of armed conflict. But I used to have, because of the I had to sustain my own morality, I used to get the major that worked for me to update this thing I stuck on the side of my targeting computer. And it listed the most recent terrorist attacks throughout Iraq. So 150 women and children were killed in a market somewhere, and in order to kill and maim more, they placed the LPG containers on the roof of the car instead of in the boot, so that you could get a better, you know, this is the kind of thing. And I'd say to myself, you know, I need to justify why I'm killing people. And I used that for some period of time, but I got to say, it was coming so frequently. I said to the major, mate, you don't have to update anymore. I know who the good guys and the bad guys are. It's appalling, John. And we must do everything to stop it.
And from my own perspective, I'm one of those Australians who's not had to go to war. But I've got to say to you right now, as I look at my own four children, my grandsons, don't have any granddaughters yet, I think how appallingly concerning it is that we could end up back there. My own father, I grew up in the shadow of war, although I didn't have to fight. My own father was in the Australian 9th Division, the one that was left when the rest of the troops were brought back.
Back from the Middle East.
From the Middle East in the Second World War. He was in charge of three anti-tank guns. They were told on the second day of Montgomery's great push against Rommel, one of the only two major battles that Australians were really involved in the Second World War, Alamein and Milne Bay, turning point type battles anyway. They were told to dig in. They got two guns dug in. They couldn't get the centre one dug in. As the light started to emerge in the morning, they realised that there was a Panzer with its gun pointed straight at them. It opened fire as they saw it. A young man panicked, jumped out of the trenches. My father, who would have been about 4 or 5 years older, that's all, jumped up to drag him down and was very badly wounded. His mates found him in a hospital tent that night, in the oxygen tent. They said, can we go and see him? They said, no, he's unconscious, he won't see the night out. He did, but that gave him an abhorrence of war. He wouldn't go to Anzac Day services. He didn't want to talk about it. He had his military mates, they'd get together, they'd have a few beers, they'd talk about the light things, never talk about the war. But he died at the age of 72, partly from those war injuries. And I was a man of 28 or 29, still occasionally hearing my father wake up in the middle of the night screaming,
is that right? Yes.
Get down, reliving that moment of terror. We don't want to go there again. But are the Chinese, the old Chinese saying, if you want to preserve the peace, prepare for war, is it true?
Oh, undoubtedly. But the vast majority of the population have never even considered that particular issue. The vast majority of the younger population haven't looked at warfare apart from the myths and legends that we have in relation to Anzac. This is the Australian population. Many of the universities still talk about the subject. Strategic and Defence Studies Centre in the ANU is good. We have some good think tanks that address these issues. But I still don't believe there is a belief that we will have to fight for our very existence again. And let's hope we never do. The one thing that struck me in Iraq was, apart from the fact that a lot of people died and on occasions I contributed to it or I saw the end results of it, what struck me was the destruction of a society. And as soon as you take away the props of our society, and we're in the middle of Sydney here, and I look out and I see the props of our society, the energy, the transportation, the accommodation, as soon as you take that away, our societies collapse very, very fast. We're seeing that in the southern Philippines. We're seeing it in many countries in Africa at the moment. I certainly saw it in Iraq. And the pressures that you put on people, we're seeing it in Syria, where 5 million people have been displaced. 500,000 have been killed. And this is a civil war, an appalling civil war. The lesson it teaches me is that strength deters, and weakness provokes. So if we've, you know, people sometimes talk disparagingly about a nuclear deterrent. Well, you know, it's worked so far. Let's hope it keeps working for a long, long time. But underneath nuclear deterrence, you certainly have conventional force deterrence. But military force in relation to a country which is finally called on to defend what it is for the good reasons that it may wish to defend those, has got much more to do with society than it's got to do with the military. The resilience of the society, the ability of the society, the governing ability of the society is really what it's all about. And you made the good point before that Australian military history is not replete with Australians commanding campaigns. We have a history of sending our forces, magnificent though they be, to support other countries who have control of the wars and the campaigns. And I think this is what we really need to develop. The vast majority of Australians must continue the beautiful existence we have in this magnificent country. That's what a good defence force must provide to the country. But there must be those who study war, and the leadership of our country, because you in this beautiful society, you can't interest people in a fight for national survival. It's all about government
leadership. Unless it's
leadership.
Under threat.
Unless it's visible to every member of the society, then it's different.
Yeah. But that's a very important word, isn't it? Because you and I think, would say, actually, it is under threat, but it's not visible enough yet.
Correct.
So people haven't caught on. They need to catch on. That's partly why we're talking now.
And I think the government, when they're talking about foreign influence, when they're talking about encryption, when they're talking about cyber legislation and cyber protection, when we're talking about spreading our economic dependence across the world, then the realisation is starting. Mm.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So I think, but I still think this is the biggest leadership challenge that government faces. Governments show, and you know better than I'll ever know, governments must show leadership all the time, particularly on things that people don't see.
Very interesting. That there's a very big issue here that has to be opened up, and we can't spend much time on it now, but it's an important one to me. Man's inhumanity to man. How on earth one human being can ever justify in their minds what some of these frightful people do on the battlefield, the way in which they're prepared to decimate communities, ruin children's lives, and wipe out generations of progress. It's just extraordinary. The French philosopher Blaise Pascal talked about humanity as consisting of the glory and the scum. Now, he actually wouldn't have made a neat division between two people. He would have said all of us contain elements of each.
Oh, yes.
But how it is that some people can resort to the depravity, and the important point out of that is Australians by nature, although I worry about the hatred we reflect in the public debate today and on social media, but by nature we're pretty easygoing. We assume most people are going to be basically decent. And sometimes I think it makes us a bit naive about the intentions of others in the world.
Society-wise, I think you're quite right. Australians still want to be loved. And if you're a real tough power, and we are, you know, I always say to people that we have an extraordinary military potential. We're just not realising it. We've got the 12th largest GDP in the world, and Russia is the 13th largest GDP in the world. That's extraordinary.
It's worth saying that again. It's extraordinary. Russia is seen as a global military power.
Yep. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers, nuclear deterrent, thousands of tanks.
None of us want to live in that sort of society, but it makes the point, doesn't it? That, you know, people say, oh, we're not big enough to look after ourselves.
Correct. That's the point it makes.
That's the mistake.
So, and since the end of the Second World War, or really since about 1942, 43, the chance of us being invaded has been zero. The chances of us having to stand up has been pretty well zero. We've tried to contribute to the stability of the world by sending small forces to work with the Americans or the Brits, or work in coalition. And with one very minor exception, we've never conducted a military operation outside of a coalition. So we are coalition partners. Mm. The problem we face at the moment is that the world has changed. The world has changed since the 2016 Defence White Paper, which everyone is working on. It was the best Defence White Paper. And over the last couple of years, We have produced the Australian Defence Force at the best standard, the best equipped I've ever seen it. But the world has gone ballistic in that period of time.
Yeah, now let's, I want to really pursue that, but just before we do, I'm fascinated by history, and all great military leaders are. You know, a lot of people debunk history, and it's very badly taught, but economists understand history.
Yep.
A good political leader will understand read history.
Yeah.
And the military understand history is vital, isn't it?
Yep.
Because you can learn not only what to do, but what not to do. I was talking to retired Admiral Andrew Robertson recently in one of these conversations, and one of the things we got to, just on this history, because it really tells you a lot, when people say, no, Australia can't do it, we're too small, we're defenceless, so don't even try.
Yeah.
It's worth remembering that we'd only been a nation for 6 or 7 years when the federal government, concerned about what was happening in Europe, recognised that something ugly might be coming, and they ordered a Tier 2, a major navy. And it sailed through the heads here in Sydney 5 years later.
Yes.
It fired the first shots of the First World War.
Did too.
It secured the Pacific, which was occupied in many parts by the Germans at the time. People forget that.
Yes.
A nation of 4.5 million, only 7 years a nation, was prepared.
And then, of course,
it broke
absolutely.
Out. Second World War, during the 30s, we're asleep. We were more with Chamberlain than with Hitler, despite Japan.
Mm.
And in many ways, I think we let ourselves down in the Second World War. We thought Britain could look after us. Singapore showed they couldn't.
Yep.
And I'm not being critical of Britain there. I'm just saying we should have been more alert.
Correct.
At the peak of the Cold War, we had a very effective Air Force, a significant army, and a very powerful Navy. But now, at this time of great change, which you're about to come onto, as a lot of people have been saying, we seem to be asleep. And to put a bit of focus on it, we're so busy tearing ourselves apart about domestic political issues, we're forgetting about the things that we need to unite on, the guerrillas on the horizon, economic and even strategic. So that changed strategic environment, to get back to what you were
leading
into.
I think that the strategic environment has changed dramatically, and I think there are two major changes. And the way that I put it is the first major change is that our great and powerful friend, the United States, no longer has the military resources to meet the expectations of all its allies. So the US commits itself to being active from the Baltic, through the Mediterranean, through the Atlantic, down into the Gulf, across the Indian Ocean, up through the South China Seas, into the Pacific, into the Atlantic, and all areas between it. At the end of the Cold War, they structured their military, they had been structuring their military, on the basis that they could win simultaneously two big wars and a small war, as I said, simultaneously. That's extraordinary. They were prepared to pay to have millions in their defence force, to have 600 ships in their navy, to have an air force second to none. They have lost interest in that. they are no longer prepared to pay for that. The discussion in the United States at the moment, by those who are interested in military affairs, is to the effect, can we win one war? Now, every nation expects what we expect. Malcolm Turnbull, I remember, in his very famous and very successful meeting with President Trump, said that the American military is the centre pole of Australia's defence. If it is, we're in big trouble. Because the American military, after 15 years of war in the Middle East, 8 years of President Obama and 7 years of sequestration, of arbitrary cutting by Congress, they are not sure they can win one war. So that's the first thing that changed. The power of our great and powerful ally has changed. And we can say to ourselves, we are the greatest benefit in the world of globalisation. We trade across the world. We're a regional superpower. As we were talking about before, our GDP is larger than Russia's. We trade and trade and trade, and we're fabulously wealthy. All of this because America was prepared to pick up the security bill for the Western world. Now they're no longer prepared to do that. They're being challenged, and this is the second thing that's happened. The first thing was the diminution, real and comparative diminution of American power. The second thing that's happened is that throughout the world, and I am very reluctant to ever mention in this context China. because and we know that China is our biggest trading partner. 30% of our exports go to China, and we need it. We need China. We should welcome China into the world, but we should welcome it from a position of strength, entire strength, economic strength, government strength, military strength, social strength, etc. But the Americans aren't as polite as I am. And in their national security strategy, the Americans say that the West faces a challenge from four nations and an ideology. Those four nations are Russia, Iran, China, and North Korea. The ideology is obviously Islamic extremism. And we're doing okay with Islamic extremism. We're belting it down wherever we find it, fighting beside our Muslim brothers. And we'll be doing that for the next 100 years. And, you know, IS as a caliphate has gone. The Islamic State as a caliphate, a geographical caliphate, has gone, but there'll be another one. There'll be Islamic extremism will rise again.
You've got a horrendous number of very, very, very highly trained jihadists out there, potentially including in this country.
That's quite correct. And we also have, you know, people. We have good police forces. We have good intelligence agencies. We're knockers of ourselves, but we run a good society, and we've done very well. Tomorrow we may fail, but it won't be the fault of these of our intelligence and our police forces. So you've got...
I think we owe them a great debt.
Oh, hell yeah.
And to be honest, it's easy to mock governments, but in reality, they've ensured that the resourcing and the determination has been there.
Yep.
You know, whether you're talking America, whether you're talking Britain, whether you're talking Australia, many other countries, a lot of our people are safe today and not worried about it, and probably even glib sometimes in their assumption as to why this might have happened. But there's been a lot of work go into it. We've done well on that front, I believe.
Mm. And government has led. And government has led well, and it's funded well, which is the key to it all. But it's not. Terrorism is not going to bring us to our knees. Mm. Terrorists will hurt us. It'll hurt society. It'll destroy society's faith in various things. But it won't bring us to our knees. The things that will bring us to our knees, I believe, are two things. The first is a financial crisis. Mm-hmm. Second thing is these four nations that we talk about, and a conventional war. And you go back through history, and there has never been a situation where one war has broken out, almost never, and we fight that one war and we win the fight.
Somebody else sees the opportunity.
Absolutely. Someone says,
make trouble.
Exactly. Suppose something happened in the Baltic. The Iranians might say, well, wouldn't this be a good time to do something in the Gulf? And I don't like going into scenarios, because people can always challenge scenarios. That's going into scenarios are the job of the intelligence and the contingency planners in defence. They go into the deep scenarios and they plan how we should react, or I hope they are planning how we should react. So you've got those... you've got a financial crisis, which could be our fault. It could come to us in some way that it's come to us before, but be worse. It could then lead into the weakening of the Western world, and that might be the thing that provokes a military crisis. So there is evil in the world, and we should never forget that. You don't want to be paranoid about it, and the aim of governments and the aim of the military is the vast majority of Australians should never have to concern themselves with this. But my view is that it is prudent in the extreme to be preparing for a big challenge in the future.
I'm going to pick you up there, because you're kinder than me. You say that governments and the right authorities and so forth charged with these responsibilities should look after these things so we don't have to worry about them. I actually think in a democracy like ours, there's a real problem. Greg Sheridan's talked about a defect in our national character.
Yeah.
We actually need to shape up. We actually need to say to governments, listen, we know the world's serious and we want you to get on with it. One of the issues, as we sit here now, there's an election not far away. Frankly, our preparedness for a dangerous world ought to be one of the top things on our worries. Well, we're tearing ourselves apart. But if something cataclysmic goes wrong economically or strategically, and they may very well be linked, because we had a debt crisis that nearly led to complete financial meltdown just a decade ago, and that debt crisis was resolved with more debt.
Yes.
It's a very unstable situation. Australia is relatively strong in that sense. Had a bit to do with a certain government that happened once upon a time.
Absolutely.
And the current government, in many ways, is getting things back under control. But it could trigger all sorts of outcomes. And we need to be cognizant of the need to be financially strong at least not crippled by debt,
mm.
and looking to the strategic horizons as well. That requires a willingness on the part of the people to make the necessary adjustments, not to just feel, but to think. And yes. Henry Kissinger himself, no less a figure, has said one of the great dangers to the West now may be that the people won't make the necessary adjustments. They're not prepared to make the sacrifices that governments need them to make in the face of these dangers.
If the threat is obvious enough and is facing us enough, and the people can see it, we will rally around and we'll do the right thing, what we would expect Australians to do. The problem is that if you were a power challenging the West, you don't give countries like us 2 years to figure out that things are going on and to get prepared. You work from the inside and you convince countries that there's nothing to worry about, it's all going along quite well. And one of the things that Malcolm Turnbull and I agreed on was that the greatest threat to this nation is what we call Finlandisation. And during the Cold War, Russia didn't invade Finland, they just controlled every aspect of it. And we are so vulnerable to that.
Lee Kuan Yew warned about that.
He did too. And Lee Kuan Yew, exactly.
The greatest statesman that Asia's produced.
Absolutely.
In the last, I don't know how long.
50 at least years.
Yeah, he warned very bluntly about it.
Yes.
Back in about 2000.
How do we avoid that? We avoid that by being independently strong. Now, our military has been optimised for the last 75 years to be supporting a Western alliance in the rule of law throughout the world. And we've done good things, and we've done some things which were pretty clumsy in relation to doing that. Now we've got to change. We've got to say to ourselves, we can be a very, very good ally, the best ally, by being able to independently produce military forces which match the threat that is towards this country. And I still think that our thinking is far too much on the basis that all we need is forces to send a small force to the Middle East to work with the Americans, or go to Marawi to assist the Philippines. The military is getting on with this, but I'm not too sure that our energy resilience is getting on with it, our ability to manage our harbours, our liquid fuels are getting on with it. I'm not too sure whether we're doing what you were inferring before, that is bringing the population along with us. I'm not too sure that a modern conflict can be managed by the National Security Committee of Cabinet. There is probably a much more sophisticated way of running modern wars. Now, the military is roaring along and doing as much as it can do.
There's been a substantial injection of funding and a lot of new hardware coming through.
There has, but and this government has done more since Howard's time. Howard realised that we need to build the military up. He was doing a magnificent job. We then struck the Rudd-Gillard Rudd years, and down we went.
But a lot's changed.
Yes.
Obviously, I was part of that administration.
Yes.
But as you said, it's changed dramatically since 2016,
yes.
Let alone since 2007. Yes.
And we keep saying that we're putting $200 billion into defence. When is it going to produce capability? See, as a military commander, I'm not interested in how much you're spending on defence. I want military capability. Yes. I want things that you can use to fight to achieve the government's national security aims. We are doing well, and I thank the government from the bottom of my heart for what this government is doing. What your government did, we saw the benefits of that when John Howard was PM and Peter Lay was the chief of the army. I saw it from the army's point of view. We lost all that because of the Rudd-Gillard Rudd years. We're now building it up again. Now, if we lose it again, this will be the greatest tragedy. When does that $200 billion produce combat capability? 2034? 2054?
We'll come to this in a minute. A very, very important point.
Yeah.
But let's just tease out, I think, what I hear you saying. You're in effect saying that what the people who have responsibility for this stuff should be doing is analysing to the best of their ability the possible dangers that could confront us.
Yes.
And they're multiple.
Yep.
I mean, in a very complex world, who knows who might start what?
Yes.
You know, it could be the superpower of the day having a miscalculation with a rising superpower, but it could be any one of those other trouble spots.
Yep.
That suddenly sparks something.
Yes.
We don't know, but we need people who will carefully analyse that. And then surely the key then for governments is to pick up on advice on how to prepare for the most likely of those scenarios? Is that the way you see it working?
I'd go slightly different. I'd say that in the past, what has driven our Defence Force has been the availability of money. We know that we've got to provide forces because our national security strategy, implied though it was that if we support the Americans now, the Americans will support us in the future. Well, that's worked brilliantly so far, but it won't work anymore because the Americans will not regain their strength until 2034 at the earliest, and probably not until 2050. I do not see that they can put the money into their defence force to build their defence force back up to where it was.
Their public finances are in a truly awful state.
They are.
As we now know, so are China's.
Yep, and they are. Right. And this is causing the turmoil and confusion in the world. The point that I make is that rather than go through another defence white paper, we should, and a defence white paper always starts from, well, we're prepared to go to 2%. 2% of GDP. Yeah. Build me a defence force based on 2%. Well, we still haven't reached it.
That is not logical.
It's not logical.
We haven't reached it, but it's not logical.
No.
Surely the logical approach is to say, what are the discernible threats?
Yes.
What do we need to meet them?
That's exactly right. Now, in the past, we could get away with any defence force we liked because we knew the Americans would always be there.
And the British before that.
And the British before that. Now it is different. We must start with, and this would be highly secret, this would never come out, with the real strategic world. Who are the real threats? We then bring that down for something which the Brits and the Americans over the years have done. They've come out and they've said, we must be able to fight a certain kind of a war against a certain kind of enemy with certain forces in a certain period of time. And that's we refer to that as an operational concept, but it's an indicative one. The contingency plans, if you're going to fight country A, you might have contingency plans. Well, you know, we can't say we're going to fight country A because we don't know whether country A is going to be worth fighting. But what we need to do is we need to say that should we fight country A to Z, the worst that can happen to us is a certain operational situation. Can we meet it? How do we meet it? How do we win? How do we then stop that ever happening by being so strong? Now, this happened to the Chinese after the first Gulf War. Chinese and the Russians looked at the first Gulf War where the Americans just wiped the opposition.
The technology just...
Absolutely. And they said to themselves...
Which has probably led to... We probably still think the Americans...
They do.
...have that leading edge that can't be challenged.
Absolutely. This is no longer the case. I went to Iraq thinking American strength was absolutely unchallengeable. And I suddenly found out that the Americans have got only... They've only got 10 divisions full-time. In a serious war, it will take them months, if not years, to prepare their reserve divisions to go and fight. Their navy is half the strength it was in 1987, at the end of the Cold War.
Half
the strength, from 600 ships down to below 300 ships.
In relative terms, of course, our navy at the peak of the Cold War was infinitely more powerful than it is now. Starting to be corrected.
It probably was. And this is, you know, navy must, in my view, we've done a lot for Air Force. We've got a brilliant Air Force, but I'd put in another descriptor. It's a brilliant little Air Force. It is leading edge when it gets the Joint Strike Fighter, but it's little. Our Navy has got to be is building and building and building. But when do we get it all? 2054. If anyone thinks we can get between now and 2054 without a defence emergency, I'd like to sell the Sydney Harbour Bridge to you.
Well, let's come to that. So we've established, you know, you've got to plan carefully for the eventualities. That doesn't see the light of day. You then design your defence force and you then determine what you've got to spend to get there.
Yes, an indicative concept of operations. Sometimes we say, because we need to spend a lot of money on defence, sometimes we say, well, all we're going to do is fight terrorism in the region because it's cheaper.
That is, in my view, that approach is an immoral thing to do to the
Absolutely.
Next generation.
Absolutely, because if we prepare for war, the probability is we will not have to fight it.
And that's just re-emphasised that both, you know, and I believe this, I know you well enough to know it's absolutely true of you and it's certainly true of me. Our whole objective here is not to sort of say, let's beat our chests and go looking for trouble.
Yep.
The whole objective is to make sure that we're fit and ready and able if somebody wants to make trouble for us.
Yeah. But the biggest problem that we face...
we get caught in somebody else's...
Without doubt. And collateral damage from a clash between, say, the Chinese in the South China Sea or the Pacific Ocean and the Americans, collateral damage on us would be they'll close every port on us. They'll stop all the liquid fuel coming into this country.
Now, let's come to that, because this is really interesting. You've alluded a couple of times, obviously, to the submarines. There's been a lot of brilliant writing on that. Now, as I understand this issue, back in 2009, there was essential agreement in this country. As a matter of some urgency, we needed to obtain 12 state-of-the-art submarines, the ultimate deterrent. Remember, we're an island nation. That's a wonderful thing. We're protected by water as long as we can hold that water.
Yep.
So submarine scene is critically important. We needed 12. We got to basically the end of 2018-19 before we even ordered
them. Haven't done anything, yeah.
They're not off the shelf. We're going to redesign submarines that are designed for nuclear propulsion.
Yeah.
We're going to put diesels in them.
Mm.
And staggeringly, the first, we're told we'll get here by 2034.
Correct.
The last in the mid-2050s. And then what do we do? Hold up a flag and say, hey, we're the nice Australians, we're not ready, so...
Wait for our submarines. Isn't
this a nation at sleep?
I think it is. It's a nation asleep in general, but on this particular issue, this is a particularly difficult issue. We've got a good submarine force at the moment. We've got the Collins class, which, because we started maintaining it and improving it, finally, it's a good, I'm told, it's a world standard submarine force, something like it puts three boats to sea, has one for training and the other two are in maintenance. And that's the world standard on a six boat fleet. If we're going to take that into the future in some way...
Sorry to interrupt. Just how many submarines do the Chinese have?
I don't know the exact number of submarines that China's got. It's about 70, and they've got there very, very fast, and they're in secure bases, and it's a very sophisticated setup. Indonesia is much the same. Indonesia are buying off the shelf. But I think the critical factor to remember is that within a decade or so, half the submarines in the world will be in our region, and that's the critical factor. Submarines are critically important. Half the subs in the world will be in our region in the future. We've got to have a submarine capability.
Just a matter of interest, if we had to track them, can you do it with conventionals, or do you need the speed and the range of nuclear powered?
Again, as a good infantryman aviator, I don't know the answer to that question. But the tracking now is not necessarily dependent as much on following one, but on the arrays that exist on the bottom of most oceans of the world. And they've been there for a long time, and they'll be put down there and revitalised by all the countries in the world. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're in our region as well.
Well, it is worth remembering that we just couldn't get one there because we didn't have many and they were a long way away and they were slow when we wanted to monitor a Russian submarine at the time of the G20.
That's very, very true. I had forgotten about that. What I find, though, is that with my base of knowledge, I have some vague understanding of submarines, but we've got to rely on the professionalism of our submarine arm. And they tell us that if we're not going to go nuclear and we can only spend a certain amount of money, these are the best submarines we can get for that amount of money. I think that what's important for us, if we are going to be truly deterrent, we don't do it with 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 infantry battalions. We don't do it with 2 big fat ships that are beautiful ships. We don't do it with 3 air warfare destroyers. We've got to have something which reaches out and can hurt an enemy. Now, so many people in this circumstance revert to cyber warfare. Now, that's the greatest cop-out that God ever put breath into, because cyber warfare will shape the conflict. It won't decide the conflict. So cyber warfare will take your banks out, it'll stop you pumping fuel, it'll stop you doing, you know, doing this and doing that, and it'll degrade your command and control systems. But you unless you have got absolutely no guts as a nation, you won't lose a war through cyber. And if you're half smart, most of our military systems will be cyber resistant. So they will, as the old saying goes, they will degrade gracefully and you can still operate with them. So it will still come down to what they call a kinetic conflict. And there's no point, if we're going to put billions of dollars as we do into very, very smart systems, there's no point not protecting them against cyber attack. But in the end, it's not the cyber attack brings you to your knees, it's the kinetic attack that brings you to your knees. And at the moment, we work on 2%. We're still striving to get to 2%. 2% buys us
GDP.
2% of GDP for spending on defence.
Americans spend what?
They spend about 4.5%. According to the president, they spend 4.5%. Some people say they spend less.
Yeah. I think it would have been less during the Obama years.
It may have been less during the Obama
years. Put that in context, the Americans spend 20% of their GDP on health.
Yes, and this is it. This is it. We can find in our society, even if we went through a financial crisis, we could still find the resources to greatly increase our capacity if we had to. Let's hope we never have to, but we could do it if we had to, if we've got the right government to lead us. But bringing that all back down to where I think it should be, 2% of GDP spent on defence buys us a medium level hedging strategy. And what that's a Gucci way of saying, yeah, we've got enough to be prepared if we really have no idea what's going to happen. So we've got enough submarine captains that if we have to expand the submarine force relatively fast, we can generate other submarine captains. Or we've got enough infantrymen who know how to be infantrymen and they all get promoted 2 ranks up and you can produce more of that. We've got enough pilots to do this and that. That's a medium-level hedging strategy. If we face a combative Asia, which I believe we face now, or an Asia which is actually aggressive, then we've got to go higher. Just because if 2%, see the world has worked, the Western world has worked on 2% since 1945. NATO always said, well, you know, America will provide 2% of our GDP. They never did it. Rarely did they do it. The Americans just, because it was in their interest, they went over the top and filled the holes. If 2% was the correct percentage when America dominated the world, why would it still be the correct percentage to spend on GDP when America no longer dominates the world? And this goes back to what we were saying before, and that is we must stand on our own 2 feet. We can stand on our own 2 feet. We can afford to stand on our own 2 feet. And the first step in doing that costs you nothing. That is to do a national security strategy.
Well, I hope that's happening, frankly, but I can't know anymore. Let's come, though, to, and I've been pretty tough, frankly, on the powers that be in relation to what's happened with submarines, because I do see it, like a lot of people I meet, as clear evidence that we haven't been taking this stuff seriously enough. We've been pretending the world is still safe because the Americans run it and we don't have to worry.
Yeah.
And everything tells you that's changed, as you've outlined. But there's another example that horrifies me. I just cannot come to grips with the fact that we've let this happen. We no longer produce any crude in this country of worth mentioning. Very little refining capacity. We're a totally energy dependent country. And I know many people are heated about the energy debate, but the reality is we are utterly dependent now and in the foreseeable future, particularly on diesel, just to keep the economy going, to keep the grocery stores and the chemists and the economy flowing. We're meant to have 90 days of fuel reserves, as I understand it, and under the International Energy Agreement, if somebody gets into trouble, they can be helped by the others and so on and so forth.
Correct.
How did we get to a situation where the last time I looked, we had about 18 days of diesel and around 21 days of petrol?
Yes.
How did we get there?
Well, I think we are...
Why is it not up in lights? Why are Australians not saying, the government that fixes this, because it's so important to every Australian, regardless of your debates about all the other social issues that are around at the moment, is the one that gets my support?
Absolutely. And I've got to say, to the credit of Josh Frydenberg and Angus Taylor, both of them have moved into this area despite the fact that they were at the time running the biggest aspects of energy in this nation. The way we got into it is that we allowed the commercial requirements to drive us because we didn't have to do it. We didn't need lots of fuel in this country except for national emergencies and big harvests. We didn't need lots of fuel in this country because if someone closed down the sea lines of communications, our good friends the Americans could always open them. We go back to the tanker wars in the 80s up through the Gulf. Vast proportion of our fuel comes from the Gulf. It might go to China first or to Japan first or to South Korea first, get refined and be sent back to us.
Although,
or
again,
to Singapore
you're
first.
Back in the 80s, we had a very high degree of self-sufficiency. People don't know that.
Yes, we had seven
we had
refineries.
Our own. Yeah. Yeah, and our own crude.
Yeah.
We were virtually 100% self-sufficient. We're now below 10,
right.
I think, now.
We import 90% of our product.
90%.
Yeah. So we produce 10%. But it's strange because yes, we produce 10%, but we export crude. We import and we also export some product. So the whole thing is purely run on a commercial basis. If say a refinery can find a good place to send its crude, it sends its crude, and it doesn't refine it itself because you can buy much cheaper refined product from out of Singapore. And your figures are quite right. We only have roughly 21 days maximum of petrol, diesel and aviation fuel in this country. And that is brilliantly successful from a commercial point of view. It's not very successful from a national security point of view because all of our fuel comes by ship, comes through our harbours. And harbours can be closed very, very easily. We've spread the sources of those fuel of that fuel supply over a large number of different countries and different sources to give us flexibility. But if you prevent the ships sailing to Australia, then we're in big trouble. Now, the innovation, I've been working on this now for about 9 months. The innovation in this country in relation to producing fuel from alternate sources is mind-boggling.
Oh, it is completely.
Biofuels and
gas to liquid?
Exactly, gas to liquid using the byproduct of our LPG, our LNG exports. But what we're lacking is a realisation that's a problem in the first instance. We're only starting to realise it's a problem. Secondly, we don't realise the risk that problem is presenting to us. And the Josh Frydenberg and Angus Taylor have both directed the department to conduct a review to express the problem, to express the possible solutions to the problem and the risks that doing this. Now, I'm not asking government to spend 1 cent more on this fuel. What I'm saying, though, is that government must realise the risk it's taking by not spending money on this fuel. We don't want to store fuel. The last thing we want to do is have billions of, you know, have a 12-month supply. What do we consume a million litres a day of petrol, of fuel. We don't want to store 365 million litres to give us a year's supply of fuel like the US has got, because you know that fuel doesn't last. You've got to manage that fuel. We don't want to get to that game. We need to store more than we've got. We then need to look at how we can expand the refineries. So maybe add 10-20% onto each refinery, and maybe the government has to pay for that. We need to be able to localise it. If you can produce an organisation that uses biofuel near Albury somewhere, means we don't bloody have to put the fuel into a diesel truck and drive it out to Albury.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, there are a lot of options like that, but we haven't been doing it.
We haven't been doing it.
And can I tell you, the disconcerting note for this, for me, is I'm very glad to hear their ministers now taking it seriously, but where were our officials on this one? Well, they must have known it was an issue because, I do pick things up. Yeah. Washington can't believe that we've been so irresponsible.
I know. But I guess I don't know why the answer was, but I kind of justify it myself by saying, well, we always knew the Americans would look after us. Well, those days have passed.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. This has been very, very interesting. I hope people will listen. It'd be very interesting to hear their reactions. And you're a public figure and I'm not hard to find, so they'll let us know.
They will.
But I just reiterate again that both of us absolutely abhor the idea of us getting tangled up in something nasty that ruins our way of life or impairs it or even takes away our freedoms. But the price of ensuring that doesn't happen surely is being alert to the dangers and taking the necessary preemptive action. You know, we tell people, look after your health so that you don't have a heart attack. We'll look after your military so that we're not the victims of some terrible miscalculation, or worse, some evil intent.
And if I finish by saying one thing, and that is that if people think that spending $35 billion a year on your defence force is expensive, wait till you have to fight a war. The costs of fighting the Iraq war, according to the Americans, is $3 trillion, and that was not a big war. That was a bubby war.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations with John Anderson. For further content, visit johnanderson.net.au.